Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. We'll hear the second of two programs recorded at a community conference on faith and the environment, wherein representatives of four faith traditions, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and American Indian, gave their perspectives on environmental issues in light of their own faith traditions. The Faith and the Environment Conference was co-sponsored by Project Interfaith and the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society. Today, we will hear from the Jewish and Muslim traditions. The speakers will be Sandra Lubarsky, the director of the Master of Arts in Sustainable Communities program at Northern Arizona University, and Safeh Eldin Hamed, associate professor of architecture and planning at Texas Tech University. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday afternoon, March 29, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Project Interfaith, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the first speaker is Ron Simpkins, director of the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society.
She directs the Master of Arts in Sustainable Communities at Northern Arizona, and there she is a professor in religious studies. She has written broadly and widely on environmental issues, sustainability issues, and the role of faith, in particular Judaism, in the sustainability movement. So please welcome Dr. Lubarsky.
Thank you very much for inviting me here today. I am really appreciative of the conversation that's going on in this room. This kind of framing of interfaith dialogue and dialogue concern about the environment is, I think, absolutely crucial to moving along on any kind of environmental change that we certainly need in the world. As Ron said, I direct this master's program on sustainable communities, but I also have a background in religious studies. So I get to pull these things together all the time. I just want to tell you that I am speaking today as a progressive Jew, so I can place myself in that tradition. I grew up as a conservative Jew. My parents moved to a Reform Jewish congregation when we became teenagers because there were no teenagers in the conservative synagogue, a very non-theological reason for their change. And since then, there has been the development of what's called Jewish renewal. And that's also kind of a very progressive form of Judaism that is trying again to address Judaism in light of very contemporary issues. And that's where I place myself in the discussion. My presentation is divided into two parts. I start by considering the theological lay of the land. The theological or the ecological roots of the Jewish tradition are like real root systems, very, very complicated, tangled in 3,000 years of theological conversations about God and about our relationship to God. And as you'll see, there tend to be, and I won't do this throughout the whole presentation, but there tend to be two root balls, one that emphasizes God's transcendence and one that emphasizes God's immanence. And then I move from this theological soil to a set of principles that can help to guide Jews, and I'm hoping not just Jews, but others, but I'm asked to talk about ecological work from a Jewish perspective, so that's how I've framed things. So I look at a set of principles that help to guide Jews who wish to develop a more consciously ecological approach to Judaism. Okay, so part one, theology. Here's what Woody Allen feels about the part of the world that lies outside of New York City. He says, "Nature and I are two." And Philip Roth, who wrote Portnoy's Complaint, there's a part of the book in Portnoy's Complaint where he talks about his general orientation to the natural world and that it was passed down to him as a tradition from his mother, who, holding up a horse chestnut, said, "See this little stick ball that falls from the trees here? Never, never throw them at anyone. You could put out an eye." And later in the book, he has a revelatory experience about nature, an experience that happens not coincidentally when he's visiting the house of his non-Jewish girlfriend. He realizes for the very first time that the street names, oak, maple, hawthorn, are related to the actual trees that grow on those streets. Finally, for the writer Fran Lebowitz, She says about nature, nature is the thing you pass through to get to your cab. So, for these three prominent Jews, nature is alien, dangerous, or simply the backdrop to the drama of human life. So we can call this East Coast, the East Coast Jewish perspective. Now, what does the tradition say? There's a well-known Talmudic story about how a group of rabbis overrode the power of 80 witches who lived in a cave outside the city of Ashkelon. It's often retold as a children's story, and I actually read this story to my kids when they were growing up. It was 29 witches, but the real story is 80 witches. And when I read it to them as a story of rabbinic cleverness. But then I read the real Talmudic version. In the children's rendition, this is a story about how the rabbis trick the witches into believing that the rabbis have greater magical powers than the witches, and therefore that the witches should cede their power to the rabbis. And the way they do this is that they claim that they can walk between raindrops. In fact, what they do is they manage to change into dry clothes when the witches aren't looking. But the witches believe that the rabbis have some special control over nature, and they welcome them into their cave as companions in magic, to eat and to dance, and afterwards, and I have to say, of course, this was deleted from the children's version, afterwards to engage in sexual relations. But during the dancing, the rabbis again outwit the witches. As they spin their female partners around, they begin to lift them off the ground, some by their hair, some by their breasts. And this maneuver of disconnecting the witches from the earth renders the witches powerless. According to Simeon, the rabbinic leader, the witchcraft of these women does not work if their feet are not touching the ground. The witches are then executed by hanging. Lifted from the earth where their power lies, they are powerless to defend themselves. Can there be a clearer story of Talmudic hostility toward nature? The witch's power is illegitimate because it comes from the earth. Rabbinic power, on the other hand, and it's important to note that this is also male power, comes from above, from God. And here we're led to believe that a transcendent God rules over the world, and that anyone who derives their power from the earth and not from this transcendent God is engaged in a practice that must be uprooted. Nature as alien, nature as dangerous, and nature as an illegitimate competitor with God. In general, the way that Jews and other monotheists have understood the sacred is as distinct from the profane. In fact, the word profane literally means before the temple, separated from holy ground. It assumes a distinction between the place where God's presence and God's power are keenly felt and the ordinary. Added to this dualism between sacred and profane is a separation that's traditionally made between God above the world and the world below. And so if you think of the sacred geography of Western monotheism, you can imagine a horizontal line separating sacred from profane, and then a vertical line separating God transcendent from the earth below. In this map, God is what nature is not. Knowledge is gained through revelation, not through participation in the natural world. This is a sacred geometry of separation, supportive of Woody Allen's cosmopolitan sensibility that nature is not that nature is at odds with God, and thus, of course, with any New York Jew as well. Okay, but wait, I'm glad to be able to say, here's another story. This one is about a rabbi, Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, one of the key figures in Hasidic Judaism. Hasidic Judaism began in the 18th century in Eastern Europe at a time when life was incredibly insecure and difficult for Jews, and Judaism itself had become very oriented towards the written word, towards the study of Torah and Talmud. And it became a reaction. It became both a way to respond to the insecurity of Jewish life and a reaction to this very, very rigid textual tradition. And it was an attempt to infuse Judaism with joy and with the sense that a person could be in contact with God not only in prayer and study, but while they were milking the cows or baking bread. Rabbi Nachman was raised in a city, but after he married, he went to live in the countryside in the village where his wife's family lived. And there, for the first time, he encountered the beauty of the natural world, and he was bowled over by it. He developed a ritual of prayer and meditation that included going into nature where he felt a greater connection with God. I want to read to you a small portion of a prayer that he's famous for having written. "Master of the universe," he wrote, "may it be my custom to go outdoors each day among the trees and grasses, among all growing things, there to be alone and to enter into prayer. There may I express all that is in my heart, talking with you to whom I belong. And may all grasses, trees, and plants awake at my coming. Send the power of their life into my prayer, making whole my heart and my speech through the life and spirit of growing things." Imagine the response of the rabbis of Ashkelon to Rabbi Nachman. I want to also lift him off the ground and hang him. For the rabbis of Ashkelon, the earth is not God's abode. For Rabbi Nachman, God's presence is most vivid in the natural world. Now consider this verse. This is from Exodus 3:5. Passover's coming up. So here's that scene where Moses stands before the burning bush. No doubt he's dumbfounded by the sight. And then he hears a voice that tells him, "Take off your shoes." Why would he be commanded to do this? After all, he's outside. He's not about to enter anyone's home, any tent. Yet the voice says, "Take off your shoes from your feet, for the place wherein you stand is holy ground." This is the first reference to consecrated ground that occurs in the Torah. And it's interesting to note that this holy place is not in Jerusalem or even in the land of Israel, but in the wilderness of Midian. Why should Moses take off his shoes in the wilderness of Midian? Here we have a passage that tells us that the earth is sacred and that Moses should take off his shoes in preparation for coming into direct contact with the sacred. In this story, the divine is not separate from the natural world. Divinity is close at hand, under our skin, beneath our feet. Jews and Christians share the refrain, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with God's holiness." Here is the recognition again that God is imminent in the world and that because of this, all of the created order is holy. And so it's fair to say that the relationship of Judaism to the environment has been ambiguous. And I think it's fair to say that that's the case with all of the Western monotheistic traditions. All three have struggled to understand God and human beings' relationship to God. And in this struggle, the well-being of the earth itself was for the most of our time a given. Certainly people worried about whether their young children would survive, and they worried about whether the rains would come in their seasons. But they did not worry about the consequences of explosive human population growth or the possibility of species extinction or the impacts of global climate change. And so they did not worry that if they postulated a God who ruled over the earth from above, that somehow that would lead people to undervalue the earth and misuse it. And so things have gotten to be very different now, right? And many Jews then are working towards recouping this part of the tradition that talks about the imminence of God. I also think that that's something that all of us need to consider, especially insofar as with the rise of modern science, the tendency has been to favor the tradition of God as transcendent. Because if God is above the world, God's out of the world, then it leaves the world open for science to function without any interference from God. But once again, that has led us to forget that the world is a sacred place and to treat it instead as a commodity and a resource. We must also think about what it means to love God and yet to treat God's world in ways that are not loving. there's one thing that is not debated in the Jewish tradition, and that is the idea that the earth is the Lord's, that God chose to create the earth, and that having done so, God declared it to be good. And yet, too often in the Jewish tradition, as was clear in the first part of this presentation, we have thought that loving God does not include loving the earth. We've separated earth from divinity and told ourselves that we could only be loyal to one. Our task today, it seems to me, is to ask ourselves how we might love both God and the earth, and how we restructure our theology so that this is possible. So that's my first part. That's the theological ground for things. And now I'd like to turn to the second part, where I talk a bit about how Jews have some of the Jewish principles that get infused in ecological practice and some of the practices. Okay. Jews are taught that the Torah should be reinterpreted in every generation so that it keeps us alive and responsive to the world. And so it's really kosher for me to reinterpret the way I'm doing things. Judaism, in fact, has always constructed itself as a religion of interpretation and commentary. And so I offer the following, drawing on the main tenets of Judaism with a progressive Jewish twist. The first thing is I think we need to, and this, I appreciate what Terry said because it's right in line with that, and that is embrace our covenantal relationship with God and learn how to now live as good partners again, relearn how to be good partners with God. When God said to Abraham, "Follow me," and Abraham did, the covenantal relationship was born. Okay, that's the Levitical covenantal relationship, not the one that's established in creation. But God says to Abraham, "Follow me." For Jews, the legal system that eventually is called halakha comes from the root that means to walk. And that's the whole structure of Judaism is based on this attempt to walk with God. So most importantly, we are to walk with God as partners, not equal partners, mind you, but partners who nonetheless have a voice in the relationship. To sweeten the deal with Abraham, God says, if you follow me, I'll make you as numerous as the stars in heaven and the grains of sand on the shore. If you follow me, you'll see an increase in your family lineage. Needless to say, Abraham was tempted by this offer. Follow me, and you shall be blessed with abundant life. That is the general contour of the covenant. Jews are also called to be holy, as God is holy. And insofar as God is concerned with both sustaining and enhancing life, so should each individual Jew be concerned. And so our task as covenantal partners is to align ourselves with God, working on behalf of life. Now, this does not mean that our task is to physically increase the human population, as in the original promise. And here's that twist that we have to figure out how to deal with. We still want biological survival, but quantity is no longer the primary objective. Indeed, life is not only about quantity, as even Abraham knew. And at this time in the history of the planet, the unrestrained quantity of people is devastating to both other species' lives and to life systems. And so it seems that today we're called to be partners by increasing life, by fostering quality of life. A second thing, we need to admit our flaws. Even though Jews understand themselves as being in a covenantal relationship with God, as capable of following God, they also know that they don't necessarily have a good track record. There's a new book out called The Virtues of Ignorance, and this is a book, it's an idea that I'd like to convey to you. I think it's a really gripping idea. And in it, and there is virtue in ignorance, in it Wendell Berry writes that the fact that our knowledge is relatively small means that the ancient program is the right one, that we need to act on the basis of ignorance. Acting on the basis of ignorance, paradoxically, requires one to know things. For instance, that failure is possible. Error is possible. Second chances are desirable, so don't risk everything on the first chance. And this book actually led me to reconsider the story in the Garden of Eden when the first humans are told not to eat from the tree of knowledge. That's a story that's always puzzled me, especially in a time, having grown up in an age where we value knowledge so much. But now I think I understand something. Can it be because once we ate from that tree of knowledge, we thought we knew everything? Even though we only had one small bite, we began to think of ourselves as the center of the universe and as the purveyors of knowledge. In assuming too much and in underestimating how little we know about the great, complicated marvel of life, we have become dangerous to every other species and to the very processes that affirm life. And so I think the prophet Micah's answer to the question, "What does the Lord require of us?" ought to be heeded as an ecological principle, to do justly, to love mercy, and especially in light of our current love affair with technology, to walk humbly. Next, I think we need to boldly go where the prophets have been. The prophets were not afraid to speak out about the state of the world in their time, nor were they afraid to challenge power. Let us embrace their tenacity and their audacity. And let us also embrace their ethical vision. For the prophets, the great goodness of God was not to be enjoyed by a select few. It was not okay to have the poor among us. It was not okay to tolerate suffering. I imagine that had they also faced environmental degradation, these prophets would also have spoken out against the pollution of water systems, the unnecessary loss of topsoil, and the mining practices that leave mountaintops ruined and poisonous tailings in communities. The prophets themselves did not live to see the changes that they hoped for, but they refused to be discouraged. I think this is because they knew that being centered on God means being centered on the world, but not on the world as it is, but on what it could be. And that's the vision thing. The prophets knew that the world could be better, and they were compelled to work toward that future. So let us have the vision of prophets in our work. A fourth thing, think generationally. At every point in a bar or bat mitzvah service, if you've been to one, the grandparents are called up, the parents are called up, and there is this ceremony of passing the Torah scroll from one generation to the other. From generation to generation, the language is l'dor v'dor. And the idea is that this wisdom, and all of the traditions is being passed again through the lineage to this young child. Native traditions talk about seven-generation sustainability. In an eco-Judaism, l'dor v'dor, from generation to generation, can serve the same purpose. But it extends our responsibilities from the Torah scroll to the Torah of the earth. A fifth thing, celebrate the Sabbath and live by a seasonal calendar. Rabbi Arthur Waskow, one of the founders of the Jewish Renewal Movement, says, "It is profoundly necessary for us to affirm and celebrate the cycles of life if we wish to preserve the cycles of life." I think that's such a wise notion, that so much of what we do in our lives is in our heads. It's this intellectual thing. If you want to preserve the cycles of life, you got to celebrate them. And so I look at the Sabbath just quickly to mention the Sabbath. It comes once a week, and it is the quintessential ecological holiday, although that's not how I was raised to understand it. But now, all over the country, people, young students in college environments especially, are reviving the celebration of the Sabbath as an ecological holiday. Long before there was a slow foods movement or books in praise of slowing down, the Sabbath counseled us to do exactly that. It was one day in a week when we were required to spend the day doing nothing, nothing that affected the world in a negative way. Not consuming, not expending extra energy, not producing. Instead, married couples were to make love with each other. people were to pray, sing, and simply be together on a day dedicated to restoring peace. And so I recommend the Sabbath. And since the Sabbath comes once a week, it seems like an excellent vehicle for those of us who want to live more consciously in tune with the world. There's something we do every day, and not just once a week, that has implications for our lives and well-being, and that is, of course, to eat. And Jews have always been attentive to food. There's the well-known summary of Jewish history in three lines. They tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. For more liberal Jews, let's eat is actually the foremost ritual practice. For traditional Jews, eating includes the rules of eating called kashrut, which consists of ancient food practices like not mixing milk and meat, not eating pork, and those kinds of things. And kashrut actually means fit, proper, or correct. Just quickly, I recently nominated a friend of mine for an award, and he's a farmer, and he's teaching people how to farm at high altitudes. And I invited him to this breakfast award dinner. Here's what he wrote, here's what he wrote back to me. "Hi, Sandra. I appreciate the invitation and your recognition of my work. I worry about the food that will be offered by the Radisson. Can you assure that most of it comes from sustainable local regional farms that care for their workers and the environment, climate, and community? Maybe you can have Bricks and Diablo Burger to cater to environmental restaurants. My attendance would be contingent on this. Otherwise, I will be home doing chores. With regard, Chuck." Chuck is not Jewish, but in his email, he espoused what people are calling the new kosher, eco-kosher. And eco-kosher principles ask, how was the food grown? Did it use chemicals that were abusive to the land? Is it exploiting the workers? Is it wasting topsoil? Was it unnecessarily transported back and forth across the country? These are the questions then that get linked with a new kind of kosher, the new question about whether food is proper or fit. I will end by returning to the notion of covenant. The Jewish tradition proposes that in relation to other species, we can take on the role of guardians of the earth. We can be protectors, just as God protects us. This is a very different role than being managers or supervisors, and certainly very different from thinking of ourselves as having dominion. To this, I think we can add the covenantal responsibility that comes with an affirmative action to the answer to the question, am I my brother's keeper? To keep or safeguard one another and other life forms is a covenantal imperative. Madame Trocmé, who hid Jews in her little French village of Le Chambon, once said in response to the question, why did you save Jews? She said, are we our brother's keepers or not? As simple as that. As Shomrei Adama, as guardians of the earth, we can join her in her confidence that this is the simplest question on earth that brooks no compromise. Thanks.
We've heard a talk by Sandra Lubarsky, the director of the Master of Arts in Sustainable Communities program at Northern Arizona University. She was the third speaker at a community conference on faith and the environment held at Creighton University and co-sponsored by Project Interfaith and the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society. Our final speaker today will be Safae Aldin Hamed, Associate Professor of Architecture and Planning at Texas Tech University. Here once again to introduce the speaker is Ron Simpkins.
Dr. Safae Aldin Hamed is a professor of architecture and planning at Texas Tech University. He is especially a specialist in landscape architecture and has pioneered some of the work that's done in that area, notably also Islamic landscape architecture. We first ran across his work in conjunction with a religion and ecology project at Harvard University and saw some of his work there, and we said this is the person that we would like to have come and present in this forum today, and we're delighted that he was able and willing to come and accept our invitation. He's going to address a Muslim perspective, so I ask that you would welcome Dr. Hamad.
Thank you, Ron. Good afternoon, everybody. As Ron said, my name is Safi Hamad, and I teach at Texas Tech University. And I would like to begin my conversation with you today with the greeting of Islam, Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be upon you. I would like to first, I would like to thank Ron and, of course, Beth Katz for inviting me here. This is my first time in Omaha, Nebraska, and I loved it already. It's a beautiful city you have here. So, yes. And luckily enough, it's a beautiful day. I was afraid that I would come with a snowstorm or so. Yes. I would like to introduce a little bit about myself. By training, I'm an architect. My undergraduate degree was from Cairo University. I was born and raised in Egypt and went to Cairo University. I finished my Bachelor of Architecture, and shortly after graduation, I made the decision to immigrate to the United States of America. Nobody believed it. And even the steward in the aeroplane, which was taking me from Cairo to New York, was telling me, where are you going? I said, United States. And she was chatting with me about how long you would be there. I said, forever. She said, I don't want to hear all these romantic words. You Arabs all talk in a romantic, exaggerated. I said, no, seriously, I'm immigrating. I really didn't know what I was doing. I was so young, but I loved America, and I loved what America stands for, and I made my decision to pursue my career. I landed in Chicago, the dream of any architect, any young architect, to go to Chicago, place for all those famous architects. But after 2 years, I really found something very concerning about architecture that led me to decide that it's really a beautiful field and I love it, but no, I am going to rebel here and convert. I converted to landscape architecture. I went and finished my master's at the University of Georgia, and then later on my PhD in environmental planning at Virginia Tech. The reason of my revolting was that there was no concern about nature and the natural environment, at least at that time, in the field of architecture. 2 years I was working in the best office in Chicago, in the world, in fact, Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, and there was no real dialogue about the environment, about the site, about the climate and the environmental control and so on. We were building those high rises, Sears Tower, John Hancock Towers. To me, it was obvious that architects were trying to overpower nature. And that was not sitting nicely with me for some reason. And later on, of course, I realized that I have this kind of respect or love to nature as I was growing up, and this was that I would not be part. I would be part of the solution. I don't want to be part of the. Being a Muslim, especially a very young Muslim, coming to this country, nobody knew much about Islam at that time, or even until today, and I came from a family where my father was one of the earlier generation who went to university, who left his village and came to Cairo to pursue his career and his education. And all his professors at Cairo University at that time were foreigners, English, French, Swiss, and so on. So he was a very westernized man. So I did not really learn much about Islam at home. My mother was a Turkish lady who also knew limited thing about Islam, but we were Muslim traditionally until I came to America. And I learned about Islam here because I had to answer so many questions and I didn't know the answer. So I had to teach myself on my own from the books and from any source I can find in Arabic and English to answer all those questions. And of course, as my career went on, many people were asking me, especially in any design profession, architecture, landscape architecture, environmental planning, is what is the view about Islam about that? You know, what is the ethical basis? What are the values? And I have to also search that because nobody searched it before. And that's why most of my publications and most of my being invited in this country, in many universities and around the world, is really to talk about subjects like this, about Islam and the environment and Islamic gardens and so on. So that's a brief background about why I'm here. And just to assure you that there is a reason of someone who is architect, landscape architect, to stand up. Of course, I feel a little bit intimidated that the two speakers before me are full-fledged scholars of theology, and that is their life career, and they study philosophy of religion and so on. And in a way, I'm an amateur who tried to find answers to convey or to convey my culture to my American friends and neighbors and students and collaborators. I want to just agree with you that we should start with a few premises. We, you know, at least you should believe me that there is that the most misunderstood faith and culture in the world today is Islam. I lived here more than 35 years, and I lived, of course, 20 years in Egypt. So there is no doubt in my mind that the most misunderstood culture in the world, especially in the United States, is Islam. So there is a lot of layers of misunderstandings and misconceptions. The second, that the Muslim world, unfortunately, today is very underdeveloped and, in a way, without demeaning, is backward in many aspects. Educationally, the illiteracy rate is very high. The social structures are not complete. The colonizing period have damaged many of the fabrics of these societies and has not been replaced. The Western models didn't work, and it will not work. I can assure you that. And therefore, we need a fresh approach to that relationship. And any relationship starts with dialogue. So I commend the organizer of this particular symposium today. I thank them, and I really admire their work. So I'm going to ask two questions and try to attempt at least to answer them. It was really a question which I have been asked a long time ago, even since I was in graduate school. How do you see the world from an Islamic eye? And that's why I wrote several articles and chapters of books about that. It took me a great deal of research, and I used primarily the major. So there are three questions. What can religion play in addressing our global environmental crisis? What is the Islamic values pertaining natural resources? And is it practical to use this today? In other words, really, can we find a solution? We know that the Muslim world, for instance, is one of the biggest polluters. The environmental awareness levels are low, in spite of the heritage. It all started really several years ago when Harvard University invited me to speak at a conference called Islam and the Ecology. This was the last of a series of 10 conferences held in Cambridge at Harvard University, which started, of course, with Judaism and ecology, Christianity and ecology, Confucianism, and so on. And the last, of course, the youngest, was Islam and ecology. And later on, they have also something called culminating conference, where selected scholars from each faith came and sat together and tried to conclude some kind of one resolution which represents those 10 faiths. What, where are the agreements, at least? It was a very enlightening, later on, experience for me and for all others who participated. And this effort of conferences went for about 3 years and ended up with asking particular groups to write and chapter, and that was that came out in Islam and the Ecology. Why it's important? Because the size of the Muslim world. The Muslim world is today is about 1.5 billion people. So one out of five. So if you are sitting on a table with five people without any Muslim, this is incomplete. It does not represent the world. The world is one out of five is a Muslim. We cannot afford to ignore or to let 20% of the population of the humanity go in a different direction. There are 75 countries which are predominantly Muslims. Most of them are developing countries. They really need to improve in many aspects, educational, social systems and institutions, political systems, mostly dictatorial. Very few of them are really in a situation of democracy. And they are suffering and facing the same problems we do. Urbanization rampant, you know, depleting the agricultural land and the forests and the resources, trying to industrialize in order to create jobs. And of course, with that goes pollution and all other problems of resource depletion. So there is a need for an appropriate ethics. This ethics cannot be imported. Luckily, these ethics and values are available and have been used in the past among Muslims. But because the Muslim world have been in decline for the last two centuries, either because of colonization or because of just deterioration from inside, many of these values are not now observed. Most people don't know about it. And unfortunately, we look, especially in the governmental circles, that the solution for, say, terrorism is to close all those madrasas in Pakistan or in Afghanistan. Well, that's not the answer. The answer is to reform those madrasas. If you close and end up with these radicals without the teaching of Islam, you will end up with very, very dangerous human beings. Islam is calling for peace and tolerance of others. And that's what many of us don't know or aware of, including Muslims themselves. So the gap is widening. The gap between many, many parts of the world is widening. We know that. The rich is getting richer and the poor is getting poorer and so on. We cannot develop Afghanistan or Iraq or without values which will be accepted by these people. So we really need to understand the values which they will be accepting instead of forcing them on accepting foreign values, which they will reject. Also, we should stop supporting dictatorial regimes. They all failed. They all failed. And with this failure, it left us with a problem that people dislike America because they believe the problems they have is because we supported for a long time all kinds of dictators in the Middle East in particular and in larger countries. I mean, Suharto in Indonesia, we supported him for 30 years. And, you know, the Indonesians will not forget that. The Shah of Iran, we supported him, and we actually brought him back. Also, the Iranians are not forgetting that. So, and they were not successful for these people. Natural resources and the environmental concern is really a question of economic. Who will own the resources and how it should be managed? We talked a great deal about that there is a great deal of widening gaps between the rich and the poor and the north and south and the east and the west. And what we need now is a creative path to think from now on holistically that this is the human family, especially around the environment. We either all succeed to save the earth or we all will suffer. And you will find that there is an agreement among many economists and intellectuals and futurists and so on that actually there is a lot of blame to be put on us here in the United States, especially the politicians, of how to deal with the third world in the whole. What are the characteristics of an Islamic system or Islamic paradigm to deal with economics, to deal with nature, or to deal with the environment? There are six aspects, and of course, because of the time, I'll try to be very brief. Muslims believe that there is nothing called separation between religion and the state. Islam, to a devout Muslim, is a way of life, not a religion, not something to be done on Friday or Saturday or Sunday, and then you go and live your worldly life. It is something which you live 24/7. And it's based on a divine source. The Quran is the word of God, the holy book of the Muslims. They believe that this is the words in God, and it was preserved in Arabic. And although 10% of the Muslims are Arabs, but it is required from every Muslim to learn that language, at least to be able to worship the five prayers and so on. The other distinct characteristic is that there is a divine mission. There is a role for man on earth, for humans on earth. And this role is very clearly stated in several verses in the Quran, that humans are the trustees, khalifa. Khalifa means vice regent or steward on earth. In more than one verse in the Quran. And that Islam was not sent to the Arabs or even to the Muslims alone. It's sent as a message universally. The teaching of Prophet Muhammad was stated in the Quran that it is for all the universe. And therefore, because the universe is the creation of God, a Muslim, a devout Muslim, does not feel alienated from any part of the universe, whether it is the stars and the planet, other planets, or the plants and the animals and the other species, or other human beings as well. The oneness, the unity of creation, the unity of God. The unity is a very important concept, which leads, of course, to the universal thinking. Also, there is a recognition about the practicality that we are living in a world where there is human weakness, human greed, human limited capacities in many aspects. And therefore, there are ways to deal with it. The Quran is very clear that some of us will be rich, some of us will be poor. But there is a system to deal with this imbalance. And there is some criteria of how to, or someone is sick, and someone is disabled, someone is dumb, and someone is brilliant. All of this are part of the Islamic doctrine, how to deal with it. The dual management that, of course, the excellence, the word excellence came by Muhammad when he was trying to define to them, to his followers, what is excellence. And they said, excellence is when you worship God as if you see him. And if you don't see him, you believe that he sees you. What is that to do with environment? That it's not only that I'm afraid of EPA, that, or I'm afraid of the city council or the city enforcement of law against me, but I am watching God and see whether I am conducting myself as a trustee or not. Because you cannot police everyone in the world. Some people can use the wrong pesticide in their backyard and nobody knew about it. Balancing materialism and spirituality. This is called, almost considered by Muslims as the trademark. They sort of take pride in that in the Quran, God has called them Ummatun Wasata, means a middle nation. What is a middle nation? Middle nation between Christianity with its ultra spiritual nature, and Judaism with its, as it developed, ultra legalistic nature. One is addressing only the angel like in considering that every human being can be forgiving and forgetting and merciful and so on. And the other is actually taking much more assertive and, Muslims believe that they, because they are middle nation, man is matter and spirit. And there is some kind of attempts to deal with both. The same applies, and this is the beauty of equilibrium or mizan. Mizan means to balance between things. I want to say one thing. All those, someone can express their views that these are very nice theory, but how it is practically applied. Well, in the history of Islam, it was practically applied by Islamic institutions. I don't have the time to go through them all, but interestingly enough, that since the 7th or the 8th century, there was the equivalent of an environmental protection agency, and it's called in Arabia al-Hisba, Dar al-Hisba, which is the sort of like the Office of Public Inspection. A group of people under one judge will be hired to take care of anything related to nature and in the environment. What I try to actually do is to survey various characteristics of the Islamic law called Sharia and shows their impact on social interactions, economic activities, and natural resources management. The Muslims' attitude toward their environment follow directly from a belief in God's ownership of the universe on one hand and in an assigned economic trustship of man on the other. Also, a devout Muslim believes that the world was created for man to use, to transform, and to enjoy, that every person is the rightful owner of all the fruits of his or her own work. Yet his enjoyment of this cultivation and the harvesting has to be conditioned by the overall interest of the society, and that judging the appropriateness of actions affecting natural resources is not drawn in the light of simplistic mathematical formula and production capacity alone. It is rather conceived and drawn in the light of comprehensive system of facts, human values, and Islamic ethics. It's also illustrated that as a body of knowledge, the Islamic law depends on four epistemological bases. They are the Quran, the Holy Book, as a primary source, the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad as a secondary source, and the ijma', or the consensus of various scholars of Islam as a third, and qiyas, or analogical reasoning, both deductive and inductive. I like to end with a quotation from the work of the International Union of the Conservation of Nature. They published back in 1980 a beautiful document called the World Conservation Strategy. And in that book, they asserted a new ethic embracing plants and animals as well as people is required for human societies to live in harmony with the natural world on which they depend for survival and well-being. One major corner of the Islamic teaching about the environment is really opposite to what we heard about the dominion. And that is that in a verse of the Quran, and repeated several times too, that all other species are nations like you. So we are equal to every other species. And that, of course, is 101 ecology. We know if we destroy one creature, and that's why biological diversity is so important, because it is recognition that God did not create anything which is unneeded. We need every creature before destroying new species of, unknown species of plants, unknown species of insects, and so on. Thank you very much, and sorry if I took a minute more.
You've been listening to a program from Project Interfaith on Noon Forum. We've heard the second of two programs from a community conference on faith and the environment, co-sponsored by Project Interfaith and the Kripke Center for the Study of Religion and Society. Giving the Muslim perspective, we just heard Safae Al-Din Hamed, Associate Professor of Architecture and Planning at Texas Tech University. On the first half of the program, giving the Jewish perspective, we heard Sandra Lubarsky, the Director of the Master of Arts in Sustainable Communities Program at Northern Arizona University. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday afternoon, March 29, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Beth Katz, Executive Director of Project Interfaith, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.